Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source. Stimulating the U.S. economy is one thing. Reforming it is something else. President Biden has been bold on the first with record restart borrowing, but he's sounding still bolder this month with an executive order really to redesign a digital playing field that took its own ungainly and mismatching shape over the last two or three decades. The missing pieces are competition and regulation, Mr. Biden says. Monopoly power, pricing, and profits are the real monsters in a mess that could kill the country, he says. That's shorthand, but Biden's people say there's an intellectual revolution behind his remedies. It's that revolution we need to tease out and test this radio hour. How bad is bigness itself? Do the damages in dollars and cents have to be spelled out? Do the Biden remedies meet the Ralph Nader test? Zephyr Teachout is our keynote guest for two reasons. Zephyr, you wrote your own high-stakes book titled Break 'Em Up, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and Big Money. But also, when you ran against Andrew Cuomo for governor of New York in 2014, your running mate was Tim Wu, who turns up now as the revolutionist on staff in the Biden White House. Pinpoint the problem, Zephyr. The Gatsby gap, so to speak, in wealth and incomes, the vanished industries, the blight on union jobs and manufacturing. Cut to the core of causes, please, and effects and cures.
A fun little tidbit, Chris, is that in the 2014 campaign, we had a policy director who is a former journalist, enrolled in law school but had not yet gone, named Lina Khan.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Who subsequently went to law school, wrote extraordinary articles, worked on the Hill, and is the new chairperson of the Federal Trade Commission. Very proud and excited to see both Tim and Lina in such crucible roles.
And already Mark Zuckerberg wants her off the case of what to do about Facebook.
I want to underline something that you just said, which is really important. In Joe Biden's recent executive order giving 72 directives to over a dozen agencies, he gave a speech. He did not just say this is important because we have some problems in our economy or some problems of under-enforcement. He said we are 40 years into an experiment and the experiment has failed. Mm. So it is not just those watching who see this as an intellectual revolution. Biden told us it's a revolution. He didn't say we've got to do better at enforcement. Right. He said the way we are thinking about anti-monopoly has failed. And to me, that was the most significant moment. We've seen signs of this in his appointment of Wu, Lina Khan, and others. But Biden himself saying, I want a wholly new approach towards economic concentration. That's a really big deal.
You know, I was going to say just that. I mean, it sort of concentrates the mind, but it also liberates it to think that we are in a very dire, grave threat to our glory.
Yes.
And it rings true. I mean, for years now, it's not a bad economy that worries us. It's an unhappy country. And the two are connected. That's the whole point.
Yeah. So the experiment that Biden is talking about is for the last 40 years, really since 1980, when Ronald Reagan came into office, the official policy of the United States government, whether it's been Republicans or Democrats, has been that antitrust laws exist to protect consumer welfare. And consumer welfare matters. It matters a lot, which means make sure that you don't allow mergers that will lead to the price of shoes going up. Make sure that you don't allow anti-competitive agreements that lead to people paying more for cars. That is the whole purpose of antitrust law, consumer welfare, since Reagan. Reagan was clear about that intellectual revolution. The people he put in place at the Federal Trade Commission and the DOJ were also clear. But then afterwards, when Democrats came into office, they didn't say, oh, Reagan was wrong. Let's go back to the antitrust regime of the late 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. They said, oh, no, we'll mess at the margins. But yeah, consumer welfare is the point. Hmm. The problem with this consumer welfare standard is that, first of all, It sounds clean, but it's not clean at all. It's not like judges are actually very good at figuring out what is anti-competitive and what isn't. Mm. And so when they're bad at it, what they tend to do is say, well, if a business is doing it, it's probably good for consumers. Frankly, that is the shorthand problem of what we've had for 40 years. If there's a merger, well, they wouldn't be doing it if they didn't think that people would buy more. You know, this kind of circular logic. If there is a arrangement where it looks like somebody has to buy one service in order to use another, or something that looks like predatory pricing, judges for the last 40 years have said, well, they probably wouldn't engage in predatory pricing because somebody else would come back and compete against them. They actually believe that anti-competitive behavior is unlikely, so they don't see it.
No, I hear that. But the other side would say of your view, Zephyr, that you're just anti-bigness, when in fact, bigness can be a wonderful thing. If Amazon can bring you a book or a toaster or a bathtub overnight, make it easier, faster, and cheaper than buying it anyplace else, there's nothing wrong with bigness.
Well, it's not making it easier, faster, or cheaper. And I think this is one of the key things to be clear about, is that we can have same-day delivery without a monopolist in online sales. We can have nice things like being able to have a driver show up with a tap of your phone without it being controlled by Uber and Lyft. Anti-monopoly law is about many things. Consumer welfare is one part of it. It is also about protecting workers from the crushing power of a handful of employers. Mm-hmm. It is also about protecting innovators from the companies that destroy would-be competitors or buy them out. And this is really important because Biden isn't doing this as, you know, you set up a parallel, more stimulation, more regulation. Antitrust, when well enforced, is an extraordinary stimulus because it sends cash and opportunity into the regions of this country that have been left behind and the communities of this country that have been left behind, to the independent pharmacists, away from the consolidated, concentrated handful of monopolists who are gathering all the cash and power for themselves. Here is my diagnosis in short form. Concentrated power poses a central threat to democracy. It poses a central threat in the tech sphere to journalism. It poses a central threat to equality and is a major driver of inequality. And it poses a central threat to an innovative, thriving, dynamic, bottom-up economy.
It's not just Amazon. I wish you'd tick off, Zephyr, teach out, as you do in your book, instances of more and more concentration in key industries. Five corporations dominate our food supply. Another five control defense contracting. The business model in pharmaceuticals is monopoly. Too big to fail banks that triggered the Great Recession are bigger and more concentrated than they were. What is the price of that concentration, and when do we see it unmistakably?
Well, one of the prices is the total collapse of ownership of Black-owned businesses and businesses owned by people of color. The collapse of local and working-class journalism. Workers have $5,000 less a year. Some economists actually estimated it more, because when you have fewer employers who control in their industry in a geography, they set the terms. Hmm. So the cost includes the weakening of unions and, as I said earlier, the weakening of our democracy. Because one of the things that these big monopolists do, not just in the last 40 years, but whenever they have gained power, as in the last Gilded Age, is they take that surplus cash, that $5,000 from each worker, they take that and they plow it into politics to maintain and solidify their control.
Zephyr, that's another thing that makes it so fascinating, the link between the patterns of money power that rub off on every other kind of power, specifically democracy, a kind of giantism. There's an anger, there's a kind of bullying model in our politics as well as our money.
I love the phrase, the bullying model. I might use that because one of the effects of this radical concentration of power, there are two effects that are both really important, and they're not just inequality. They're what power does to those who have it and what power does to those who don't.
It was Tim Wu in his book called
Yes.
The curse of bigness, who suggested the idea to me that this has consequences, that something contagious here. He writes, if we learned one thing from the gilded age of oil, railroading, banking, century ago, the Rockefeller, Morgan era, foiled in a way by Teddy Roosevelt and progressivism in the 20s. But he said, if we'd learned one thing from the Gilded Age, it should have been this. The road to fascism and dictatorship is paved with failures of economic policy to serve the needs of the general public. That's a very large statement. Can you prove it?
I think you can prove it by looking around. But I'll tell you how I got into this area, is that I am a democracy activist. Mm-hmm. I came to realize that the biggest democratic threat we have lies in what, in the last 40 years, we have treated as living in a separate sphere. It's like we've treated like there's the political sphere here and the economic sphere here, instead of course, understanding that they have a dangerous dynamic interaction with each other. And I came to realize that we have to go at the root of concentrated power as a small d Democrat. When Tim and I ran for office, we ran on an anti-corruption platform, but we ended up talking a lot about monopolies. And I will tell you, watching a small business owner or a cable electrician's face light up when they hear that's what we're talking about, this is people's lived experience with a boss they can't leave, or somebody responsible for taking their goods to market who they are totally dependent on. People experience rational paranoia, fear, and humiliation when you have a concentrated economy, and they are dying to have leaders speak up about it, which is why you see this totally weird and wonderful bipartisanship in antitrust that you don't see anywhere else.
I don't think most people are aware, Zephyr, that this argument has been fought out gloriously in American history, and the little guys won, in effect, in the 20th century.
Yeah. I mean, one way to look at all of American history is that it has been many fights, but there is an ongoing fight against monopoly power that goes back to the Tea Party, the real Tea Party, the fight against the multinational corporation that is trying to set the terms like a mini government. The East India Tea Company.
I think it's fascinating and good for everybody that we're not arguing about how many billions should be in the bailout or what level of corporate taxation is proper and right, but we're talking about the whole megillah.
It's the operating system.
It is, and we're just well begun. Coming up, what if the fault, dear Congress, is not in the tech, but in ourselves, that we let it run over us? This is Open Source. We're talking about giantism in the winner-take-all, digitized, financialized, mega-merging U.S. economy. It's President Biden's big push this midsummer to cut some of the giants down to size by forcing competition back into the game. The mantra is, capitalism without competition isn't capitalism, it's exploitation. He actually said, a 40-year experiment in letting giant corporations gather more and more power has failed. But is it too late to regulate gold mines like Google or Facebook? Our guest, Nico Mealy, the digital pioneer and entrepreneur, was way ahead of the reform wave with a book 7 years ago titled The End of Big, How the Digital Revolution Turned Little David into the New Goliath. And we've all seen it now. Nico Mealy is also an old pal of Tim Wu's. Aren't you struck that there's a radicalism in Joe Biden's policy here that has barely been credited? He sounds as if he means this. I like John Cassidy writing in The New Yorker. He's asked at the end of his report, when was the last time you heard a Democratic president speak so plainly about economics?
It's a radicalism, but it's also good politics.
You think?
Absolutely. The last decade plus has been characterized by victories on the margin, 0.001% here, 0.1% there. If Democrats are ever going to build a larger majority, if we're going to get away from this politics victory on the margins, eking out these tiny victories, we need a kind of game-changing reframing of what's going on. We need a story to tell that brings together a larger group of Americans and gets us away from 50 plus 0.01. I think the idea that corporate power is too big and too strong and that it's affecting all of our everyday lives may sound radical to those of us who are you know, sushi eating, Volvo driving, Birkenstock wearing elite urban dwellers with substantial 401ks. But I think to most Americans, there's nothing radical about it. What's radical about it is hearing it from Washington, D.C. I mean, the two things Americans hate most are Washington, D.C. and Wall Street. And they hate Wall Street because it's the embodiment of corporate consolidation, of corporate power, of bigness, of the rigged game. And they hate D.C. because D.C.'s allowed that to happen. And so it's very good politics and takes us to a place that I'm hopeful could spell a very different era in American politics.
You are hopeful, especially given the blockade that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders ran into. And when Michael Bloomberg looked at Bernie and said, Bernie, it's called communism and it doesn't work. And they nominated Joe Biden, Mr. Moderate.
They nominated Joe Biden because he could appeal to traditional Democratic constituencies. But he also could appeal to white voters who have been trending Republican since 1980, Reagan Democrats. What do those Reagan Democrats have in common with African-American and Hispanic voters and young voters? That the economy is not working because it's been captured. A word for it is moderate, but the reason Biden was nominated, won the nomination, was because he could win.
Go back most of 10 years when you were writing The End of Big. What's the core of the problem for you, Nico?
When I was looking at the way our institutions have failed us, the consistent thread to me ultimately was about greed. A greed that has taken us away from what it means to be a resilient and vibrant community and a resilient and vibrant country. You know, a greed that has corrupted some great public servants. I think it's telling that Joe Biden's net worth is among the lowest of all the U.S. senators. Greed has corrupted American culture in the most vile of ways.
People can see it when they look at those tycoons floating around in space, the new ego trip, and the fortunes that have been made in the digital era. But is the digital technology the problem? Is it ourselves? Is it policy? Is it neglect? And how has the problem seem to get worse and worse through so much wreckage?
That's a question I'd love to hear Zephyr answer. Part of what's happened is we've ignored all the warnings. We've ignored all the symptoms.
I totally agree with Nico that there are a lot of people for whom this is not radical. They see it all the time. They just haven't been hearing it in their politicians, that this is a leading from below. And Biden has a strong connection to that. And you could hear his anger in his speech at non-compete agreements, sort of like, what the hell is that?
I want to ask a follow-up question, Zephyr. One question on my mind has been, are the current digital monopolies substantively different than the monopolies of the industrial age? If so, what kinds of new policies do we need to restrain them? And it sounds like you think that they are substantively different.
I think that they are more the same than different. What's different is that Amazon has a surveillance capacity to know a lot more than the railroads ever knew about a farmer. So what I do think is that there's some areas where we want something closer to the public utility model and some areas where we need greater enforcement.
I'm still trying to pinpoint the responsibility of the technology itself and the policies that govern it. Take Uber and Lyft, for example. The technology enables a terrific improvement in taxi service. It's that single for-profit company and often abusive control over non-unionized drivers that worries me. Could it not have been done differently by policy?
Yes, that one's actually the easiest. It's very clear that touchscreen driver for hail call was already being developed without Uber or Lyft. What they brought in was an effort to destroy local regulations. It was very much a hit on laws, local anti-monopoly laws largely, and then a lot of subsidization by SoftBank and others.
The question is, who could have intervened to make Uber a co-op?
It's what happened, say, in Philadelphia, and there was a case on this, example of how bad our antitrust laws are. Uber comes to Philadelphia, raises the wages for the drivers, they all leave their current employ, and then reduces the wages after they've gotten rid of all their competitors. That's classic predatory behavior that federal law used to do and hopefully will do again, if that makes sense.
Zephyr and Nico, I want to introduce a third party here. Ben Tarnoff He's a co-founder of Logic Magazine. He's an historian, among other things, of Silicon Valley and the digital tech that has given us the surveillance economy, among other mixed blessings. Ben Tarnoff, what is the root of our unhappiness here? What is the connection between the digital tech and the economy we have and don't much like? And what do you make of the remedies that you've heard in this hour so far? Welcome, Ben.
You said earlier that I was allowed to wear the Eugene Debs hat, so maybe I'll take a...
Well, yeah, speak of the fact that we're just reenacting the history of the early part of this century. Robert Barron's, Roosevelt, the Trust Buster, Eugene V. Debs saying the problem is capitalism. Where are you in that cast?
Well, I certainly fit into the Debs mold. And I think as we've heard from the conversation so far, history is both useful and not useful as a guide to what's going on now. I think it's essential, as Zephyr pointed out, to establish that we've been here before, that just because a service is mediated by the internet does not mean it should be exempt from a century of hard-won legislation. On the other hand, there are some genuinely new problems and new capabilities that these companies and the services they produce represent.
Well, of course it's bigger because it underlies our culture now, our conversation, our whole public life in this country, as railroads did not, even the banks didn't.
Precisely. And I think, you know, you're zeroing in on social media in particular. I think it can be important to bring a bit of specificity when we talk about tech or platforms, right? These are very capacious terms. They tend to include a whole bunch. But social media has been a particular area of emphasis, an area of concern, particularly since 2016. There's a lot of concern about disinformation, about misinformation, about propaganda on social mm-hmm. media. As you said, a company like Facebook really mediates our discourse, our kind of public square, in a way that's hard to find a precedent. It's bigger than a media company in many ways. I think this is actually a useful place where we can look at the anti-monopoly movement that's emerging and try to evaluate how effective some of their remedies would be. But this emphasis on the promotion of competition, which is associated with a leading liberal jurist of the progressive era, Louis Brandeis, and many mm-hmm. of the new anti-monopolists are known as the new Brandeisians. I worry that that emphasis won't go very far towards addressing many of the crises that have provoked the tech lash. So many of the problems that have emerged into the public eye over the past few years are rooted on Facebook's obsessive priority of user engagement, right? Everything about Facebook is designed from the ground up to make people interact more with Facebook, because that
right.
way they can manufacture more data about you and they can monetize that data in the form of advertising.
And your phones are doing the same thing to you all the time. They want to speak to you 24 hours a day.
Precisely. But when we think just of Facebook for this example, the question is, if we were to promote competition, if Facebook were a smaller and more entrepreneurial firm, if it had to compete against several other Facebooks, would that produce a better result? And I think it's hard for me to imagine that it would. Competitive pressures compelled Facebook to develop this obsession with user engagement when it was a comparatively smaller and leaner firm. And you would imagine in a more competitive landscape, multiple firms would be angling for any possible advantage and they would be incentivized to collect even more data potentially and to monetize it. So wearing the Debs hat, I would locate the core problem here not as one of monopoly, but as profit being the priority.
I wonder if it's too late. I'm thinking, among other things, of Jacob Silverman's piece in The New Republic. He writes, "We are 20-odd years into a surveillance economy in which consumers have become the main source to be mined for value. The resulting inequities are vast, as the tech giants have had decades to strengthen their positions. It'll take far more than an executive order to undo all this." I mean, it's going to be hard to get out of this mess as it is to leave Facebook.
It's never
you know,
too
when
late.
It got too late, it got too late in 1899. It was in 1899, if you were somebody who had been fighting for political rights for African Americans, against monopolies, for voting rights for women, you have 30 years of the absolute destruction of the Lincoln's Republican Party. And the alliances that were made, the powerful cross-racial alliances that were made in the 1880s. It was too late then.
Never give up. I would say never give up, but I want to see the uprising. And I'd love to see Black Lives Matter in this anti-monopoly campaign. Under the heading of It's Not Just Amazon, you have Big Ag, Zephyr, on your target list for Break 'Em Up. Explain that. Where does the issue come to the food on your table?
Frankly, I start with Big Ag because I think ag is the easiest for us to see. It's just like, are you kidding me? This is the way that we had choose to eat a handful of suppliers, seed companies, and tractor companies / financiers. In other words, companies like Tyson on the one hand, Monsanto owned by Bayer, and John Deere, all just controlling farmers and farm workers. Massive surveillance. They pay different amounts every month. They experiment. And the effect is that farmers are getting a fraction of what they did 30 years ago for everything they sell, are humiliated and angry. And these choke point monopolists are getting extremely wealthy. And I mentioned it because it's easy to see. It's easy in the chicken industry to see what Tyson and Purdue do. And then the shift is to say, that's what Uber is doing too.
Look, I think David killed Goliath with 5 smooth stones. You asked earlier, is it too late? And the answer is no. And in some ways, it doesn't take much. This relationship between big corporate power and big national politics is insidious and dangerous. And I believe really threatens the future of the country immediately in profound ways. But I also believe that, you know, I believe fundamentally in American resourcefulness, in the ingenuity of our culture, in the amazing flexibility and diversity that immigration, forced or otherwise, has brought to our nation. We have to turn back to our neighbors and to our local communities to combat big economic power and monopoly power, but also to combat the national politics. It really starts at home with your neighbors, with the things happening in your community. I guarantee you, every zip code in America, you don't have to scratch much below the surface to find examples of monopoly power and failed government institutions not doing their job.
Nico, you said to me the other day, if you want to save your country, start a local independent newspaper and a food co-op.
And probably a ride-sharing co-op or a babysitting co-op, too. We're kind of locked into a single vision of capitalism that is so narrow as to exclude many other compelling models.
Ben Tarnoff, I want your version of that remedy, a local newspaper and a food co-op.
You know, there are tons of rural electric cooperatives that were created during the New Deal that were provided with low-cost loans by FDR, and which maintain their own community power grids with meaningful democratic participation from the membership. That's a model that we can apply to much of the rest of the economy, along with public ownership, which I think needs to be democratized and made more participatory. But these are the ways I think that we can begin to diminish the power of the profit motive and actually enable people themselves to make the decisions about how they want to lead their lives.
Zephyr Teachout, your version.
You know, what does a moral economy look like? To me, we also have to talk about who will make the newspapers. But to get people to be really saying and asking and having this conversation of like, who do you want to be manufacturing shoes and how do you want to imagine that industry working? And like, let's really open our imaginations on that. What's the role of Wall Street in that? We haven't talked about Wall Street. The ultimate monopoly, the people that in the 1880s they called the money power, is the financial power behind these corporate monopolies that we're talking about, the monopolies behind the monopolies, the investors who own a piece of every airline, not just one. Forcing us to have a conversation about what a moral economy looks like is central. To me, you don't have a moral economy unless people have the dignity to choose to leave. The reason there aren't co-ops is not because people don't want them. It's because our laws don't allow them. If you have a berry co-op, I was talking to a farming activist. If you have a berry co-op, it's because Driscoll decides it's good for Driscoll's business for there to appear to be competition. So yes, I think we need the bottom-up work, but we also need the top-down work. And anti-monopoly, for me at least, includes taking on this sort of toxic profit maximization model that we have.
Well, I think it's time to imagine some new stuff. It's telling to me that the big tech companies we've got, the tech monopolies we've got, there's one that's a nonprofit, that community-based Wikipedia, that has opened up, it has its faults, but it's opened up a huge amount of possibility for the world.
Amen.
And somebody is hopefully listening to this who will imagine with their neighbors the next way to do this. There's no reason Uber could not have started as an open source cooperative. No reason whatsoever. And so the opportunity and the potential is there to both take the political action required to constrain and fight the power of the big ones, but also to simply build a different world. Five smooth stones, that's all it takes.
Thank you, Jimmy Wales. Thank you,
so
Nico
inspiring,
Meary.
Nico.
That's really a perfect example, not only of a cooperative, but all the psychic benefits of feeling that we're getting smarter together.
And as Clay Shirky points out, if you take all of the time ever put into creating Wikipedia, it's something like less than 1% of the time Americans spent watching television last year alone. There's a cognitive surplus out there that can be tapped.
I can't thank you enough. Nico Meary, Ben Tarnoff, Zephyr Teachout. Thank you all.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Matt Stoller calls it 100 years war over monopoly in the United States. Ralph Nader's been in the center of that battle for half of it. This is Open Source. Matt Stoller is a one-man band who wrote a book, Goliath, and now a weekly newsletter called Big, to explain what market power has to do with censorship and riots and political chaos. A role model, surely, is Ralph Nader, who stopped the U.S. auto industry in its tracks a half century ago with his book, Unsafe at Any Speed. Ralph Nader, this trust-busting fight sounds sort of like Ralph Nader, breaking up Google, breaking up Facebook, whatever you want. But are you in the fight?
Yeah, I mean, I like what Matt and others remind us, that the original Clayton Antitrust Act didn't just focus on consumer well-being, but it also reflected the need to politically deconcentrate these companies, the issue of democracy, not just whether the price was competitive to consumers, but we still are confronted with the reality. One, what's the use of breaking up a rotten tomato? Because you're not dealing with the best companies here, you're dealing with the worst companies who've dominated, like Google and Facebook and Amazon. And the second is, Congress is not inclined to do what Congress did in the 1930s under Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Public Utility Holding Act, where they deconcentrated legislatively. The practice now is to have it resolved in the courts, which could be 10, 15, 20 years, because the corporate attorneys are very skilled, Chris, in endless procrastination of the system. But we're at least better off because we're reflecting this executive order by Biden, which at least starts the conversation going. But corporate lawyers know that they can build a lot of trap doors between a vigorous conversation, a more competitive, fair, and deconcentrated economy.
Ralph Nader, we'll see what happens, but I'm noticing three things as new and really serious. First, the President of the United States says that a 40-year experiment in giant corporations has failed and it's over. Second, he himself is staffing up with Timbu, Lina Khan, and others, but this neo-Brandeis, neo-Teddy Roosevelt spirit of trust-busting. And third, he sounded the rallying cry, it's competition or bust. Competition, not just in the economy, but as a model of human-scale thinking in the world and human equality as sort of bedrock American-ism. How significant is that? And can you think of any other Democratic politician in the last 50 years who would have done those things?
Well, that's not a very good measure, because of the last 50 years have been deepening corporatism and corporate supremacy over our political economy. I think rhetoric is always the first start to reform. I don't think Biden, deep in his gut, believes in all this. He's Delaware Joe, after all. That's where the corporate charters are for facilitating the domination of executives over shareholders and other stakeholders. His record has been atrocious, favoring banks and credit card companies' worst practices, including student loans, as Matt knows. So we say, okay, he's got his finger to the wind. He's got to appeal to the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. He's got to appease them. And he's done it in this very large executive order. Fine. Okay. Hold him to his rhetoric. Make sure he doesn't step backward. Get him to appoint much more powerful people than the positions that Lina Khan and Tim Wu have at the present time. And let's see if he puts before Congress a larger budget for corporate anti-monopoly enforcement and corporate crime enforcement. Are they going to give these trust busters the adequate staff, the adequate power, because they're weak, a lot of these laws, and the adequate number of prosecutors to get this done if they're going to go the court route? But if you look at how they have delayed other things, you're going to go way past two terms of Biden. And so you have to build a political movement and then move it into an electoral agenda for 2022. And we got to have public hearings. What major legislation has passed in our country's history without public hearings to inform, arouse, mobilize the public? That's when you know the Democratic Party is really serious.
Can I say, Ralph, he needs a Louis Brandeis or Ralph Nader, but I'm impressed with this guy, Tim Wu, and I'm reading his books. Tim Wu is an experienced teacher and a very good writer. He did take one kind of flyer run for Lieutenant Governor of New York, didn't go far, but he also thinks it's critical to the country's survival that you cannot have monster business and democratic politics, small d functioning politics. And he believes it with a passion. Doesn't that count?
It counts, but have you heard much from Tim Wu since he joined the Biden administration? He can't do what he did when he was a law professor at Columbia. He's in a relatively powerless position, which can only have influence if he's got the ear of Ron Klain, the chief of staff for Biden, or Vice President Harris.
Matt Stoller, you helped get the ball rolling with a fascinating book called Goliath, about monopoly in American industry, in American corporate power. You're also watching the politics very carefully. You're noticing, among other things, that there is support for a competition campaign on the right wing of the Republican Party, notably Josh Hawley of Missouri, who's virtually a Trumpian and maybe aspires to succeed Trump in Republican power. Speak of the politics in Congress around this, the progressive and the illusion, at least, of an echo from the Republican right.
I would say that one aspect of the politics here, which is very strange, and I think this is where there is a difference between the 60s, 70s, and 80s, is that the conservative movement is fracturing around the problem of monopoly. Certainly, they're angry about big tech for a variety of reasons, notably that they deplatformed Trump and then also got rid of Parler. But you're also starting to see a breakdown in the business community itself, particularly among conservative interest groups. So one of the groups that praised the executive order were cattle ranchers and farmers.
Yes.
So the Farm Bureau, which is incredibly right wing, and the U.S. Cattlemen's Association, which is very right wing, they came out and said Biden trying to resurrect the Packers and Stockyards Administration, doing some things on Made in USA. We need that. And that is creating this strange dynamic where a bunch of people on the right, a lot of Republican senators have been writing about the meat packers. Wyoming just updated its antitrust laws. In the House Antitrust Subcommittee, you saw some conservative Republicans like Ken Buck and Matt Gaetz being very adamant helpers of the anti-monopoly framework. So it's this interesting moment when there's a fracture on both sides of the aisle. Like, this isn't just like a progressive thing. This is also something that anti-monopoly populists on the right are bringing forward, and the whole business community is starting to fracture as well. So it's a very strange movement. It's the weirdest movement I've ever been a part of, but we've been able to make, I think, a lot of progress. Not enough, I think, as Ralph notes. We've been able to make a lot of progress.
Well, you know, Matt is known for his optimistic hope springs eternal. And if you're not optimistic in this battle, you tend to be discouraged and withdrawn. But I look for other signs. We've been through this drill before on corporate welfare a number of years ago. I convinced John Kasich, who was the chair of the House Budget Committee, to hold the first public hearings in American history on corporate welfare. This was in the 1990s. And what happened? Nothing. Because the power structure these people were attached to simply weren't serious. And the priorities of these groups day to day and where their funding was coming from was not about corporate welfare reform, handouts, giveaways, bailouts, all the things that framed the corporate state, a government guaranteed corporate capitalism, I call it, taxpayer funded, like the Wall Street bailout. So what we have to do to go forward, it's a numbers game. You have to say, well, how many members of this committee on both sides, the Judiciary Committee, the Senate and House, are coming in on specific legislation that has been filed? Are they talking about it back home when they take their leisurely summer vacation? Is the Democratic National Committee picking it up as they work in their little cubicles dialing for corporate campaign cash day after day? Is the press beginning to take this more serious? Matt has got some good press. He's had op-eds. But one of my tests is, do these progressive people meet with the citizen groups in Washington, like Public Citizen and Common Cause and others, who have been longstanding for strong antitrust enforcement? And the answer is no. You can't even get AOC to return a phone call. I've been down to her office 2-3 times. I've called her. The only person in the squad that returns a call, and then it takes some time, is Rashida Tlaib. They just are all silos. Matt has seen this firsthand when he worked on Capitol Hill. There's just too many silos. And in the 60s and 70s, the only way we got things done was a close coordination daily between the citizen groups and the champions in the Congress. And we would say to them, we can't get it done without you, and you can't get it done without us and our membership and activity around the country. It's not happening yet.
Ralph, all that dysfunction could contribute to a solution here. It strikes me the hope of the situation is that we all feel demoralized. The country's not working, doesn't feel like its best self. And here's somebody making a connection between the giantism of these new astronauts up there with their corporate trillions of dollars, that and the diminishment of politics, the diminishment of each citizen. I think there could be a mood of, let's try something different. This isn't working.
No, there's no doubt about that, Chris. There's no doubt about it. But we want to see signs like actual legislation requiring Facebook to spin off its two major subsidiaries. Not that that's going to create a paradise. I mean, look how many years Facebook and Google have delayed as they have become giants. There was a consent decree between Facebook and the Federal Trade Commission in 2011, as Matt knows. And for years, they just thumbed their nose at this consent decree that they agreed to. They're a lawless corporation.
Are they too entrenched, Ralph and Matt? Is it too late to rescue what feels like a free country?
You know, the number one problem that we have is fatalism. What Ralph said is right, which is that to these firms, and I think the entire white-collar world, laws and regulations are just suggestions. Like, that's a fundamental problem with the rule of law. It's a crisis of the rule of law. That's what we're really talking about here. And I guess I just mentioned a couple of things to give people a sense of possibility. So in terms of funding, both the House and the Senate have passed bills to substantially raise the budgets of the FTC and DOJ, which are the two antitrust agencies. Now, they're going to have to find antitrust lawyers or train them. But that's, I think, pretty meaningful. You've also seen that both houses have passed a minor bill that allows state attorney generals to have more control over the courts that they use to prevent forum shopping. The House Judiciary passed 4 bills to address tech, one of which would probably split up Facebook's different networks. And you do have antitrust cases against Facebook and Google and Amazon. We need a lot more, but I don't think that these firms, to answer your question, are too entrenched. The question you're really asking is, do we have a democracy anymore?
It is.
Because if they are too entrenched and we can't do anything about them, and we can't do anything basically about our political economy, then do we just have the ornament of a democracy and not actually the real thing? like we were in the 1920s, we're kind of on this weird borderline between corporatism and small R republicanism.
The way to change it is quite simple. The people have got to take control of the Congress. Congress is the great potential club against gigantic corporatism because it's the only thing we have as the most powerful branch of government in so many ways. And we know their names. There are only 535 senators and representatives, unlike the judiciary or the executive branch. And if we organize a fraction of 1% of the voters back in congressional districts around corporate reform, not just antitrust, but corporate law enforcement, labor law, consumer law, tax law, that thing should ring through the country just the way Clinton made welfare reform, so-called, ring through the country. And then everything becomes feasible. Everything. The Congress can nationalize. The Congress can tax. The Congress can break up. The Congress can beef up, as Matt says, the enforcement resources. There is a direct line, Chris, between larger antitrust enforcement budgets and a number of cases brought. Direct line. So that's the focus. That's the lever that people, whether they march, demonstrate, write, litigate, all the energy has to go on to get a supermajority of the Senate and the House. Once you do that, you overcome any vetoes. You can overcome Supreme Court decisions that are made on misinterpreting legislation or trying to be ambiguous about it. And you can exert Congress's plenary power of subpoena. They don't have to go to the courts to enforce subpoena. In fact, we're trying to get tutorials of staff who don't have a clue about what Congress' constitutional powers are. The examples we could give would stun you, Chris.
Okay.
So that's where the hope is. You've got to make it a grassroots awareness.
Seems to me there could be hope in the history of this thing. Once upon a time, Ralph, in the first Gilded Age, and I know you were not there, the monster trusts did get busted. The Rockefeller Standard Oil, AT&T eventually, IBM even, coming into modern times. It can be done. What made it work when it did work? What is the model of success in that past? And does it apply today?
You know, in the old days, they didn't have that many industries that were so concentrated. The concentration in the pharmaceutical industry.
Right.
The concentration in the media industry.
Right.
All industries
banking.
Now, as Matt has written about in his books. And so there's more to break up. And you got to break it up in a way that you don't have five new companies that behave roughly the same with conscious parallelism. Otherwise, they're all going to regroup. I mean, it's like what is that movie, Alien? You know, the corporate lawyers go to work right away and they start regrouping. And when did we ever think that the government would allow Exxon, the number one oil company, to merge with Mobil Oil? When did we ever think the government to approve a joint venture in a factory in California between General Motors and Toyota? The whole issue of joint ventures is a way to circumvent the antitrust laws. There's almost nothing written on it, and there's not been a congressional hearing on it, and the Justice Department just lets it happen. So there's a lot of work to be done, and the more issues that affect more people where they live, work, and raise their families, the more powerful the citizen lobby will be on Congress, and then it radiates favorably from Capitol Hill.
It's a big challenge, Matt Stoller. Are you up for it?
Yeah, I mean, I've been working on it for a while and, you know, learned a lot from people like Ralph and Wright Patman and Ferdinand Pecora. And I think that there's a hunger for it among the public. And our job is to organize that. We're talking to a lot of businesses, farmers, artists, tech people who want this. And it's just a question of, can we put it together into a citizens' lobby and get Congress to govern again?
It's exciting to hear. It'll be a very, very interesting fight for God knows how long, but we'll be watching.
Well, it's a fight, as Matt has pointed out, for the meaning of democracy itself, of justice itself, of public voice itself, of allocation of resources itself, of appropriate technology that doesn't threaten the earth itself. We have to develop a popular language to describe the devastating effect of corporatism over democracy, of Wall Street over Washington, of every area of our life being commercialized and corporatized. I think that's what Matt and others are on to full time. So good luck.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Ralph. It sounds like a good fight.
Thank you, Chris, for the opportunity to voice it.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Ralph.
Thanks also to Zephyr Teachout, Nick O'Mealy, and Ben Tarnoff. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from the WBUR production team. Mary McGrath coordinates our radio co-op. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source. Open Source is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, the nonprofit audio collective that brings you some of the smartest podcasts out there. This week, listen to Goodbye Google, the latest episode of Soonish from tech journalist Wade Rausch. Wade is looking at Google's firing of an AI ethicist who wrote about potential gender and racial bias in the company's machine learning algorithms. Listen at soonishpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And check out the whole Hub and Spoke lineup at hubspokeaudio.org.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.